Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today I'm going to examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and look into whether the grand bargain that the White House and the Republican Congress are working on to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff will end up as the Great Betrayal. William K. Black, professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, joins us to discuss the need for the president not to cave into Republican blackmail as he did last time and to fight to preserve Social Security and Medicare. Then we will speak with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, about the extent to which the president has drunk the deficit Kool-Aid, which billionaires like Pete Peterson have been ladling out for decades. We will discuss the deficit hoax and the need for further stimulus instead of the austerity that is crippling Europe. Then finally, Gar Alperovitz joins us. He is an historian, political economist, activist, and writer who believes that bottom-up solutions to empower Americans at the local level are possible as community banks and municipal utilities are beginning to grow as alternatives to the top-down Wall Street financialization of our economy. His forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. And joining us now is William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loans disasters of the 1980s. Currently, he is a professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007, and he's the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Welcome to Background Briefing, William K. Black.
Thank you.
And you've been writing fairly regularly in the Huffington Post recently, Bill, warning about the grand bargain underway between President Obama and John Boehner and Cantor and the House. And, I mean, I think one of the things that I find as a disconnect here is that it seems that we have a blue country following the recent election, but we have a purple president. And both Obama and Clinton before him, in many ways, I think their political outlook was shaped by Ronald Reagan in terms of recognizing the politics and power of conservatism in this country. But the most recent election really indicated the end of Ronald Reagan and the end of the conservative majority. So is that a problem here, that our leaders are governing in an America that is largely, you know, passing us by?
No, there's an important part of America, of course, that still has tremendous power, and that is Wall Street. And that's why I and my colleagues at University of Missouri, Kansas City, Econ Department, in our blog, New Economic Perspectives, have been warning for some time about what we call the Great Betrayal that's coming, very much in the interests of Wall Street. You're quite right that President Clinton, long before he was president, believed that he had learned the lessons of President Reagan's success. And the lesson was we had to be more like the Republicans on national security, and in particular on social programs and budgets and such. And so the Democratic Leadership Coalition was explicitly designed, mostly run by Southern and border state Democrats, to push the party very much to the right and to align it, when possible, with the interests of Wall Street, which was seen as being the biggest and the most powerful portion of the economy and the biggest source of finance, contributions, and such. So you're right, Clinton moved that way. Clinton has proclaimed it a brilliant success, his terms, of course, and a young senator looking for a role model in terms of the way up, very much modeled himself on Clinton's. Of course, the irony is he ended up running against Hillary for the presidential nomination, succeeded in large part because he overwhelmingly got the contributions of Wall Street. And when he got in office, of course, inherited a disaster from George Bush, and that was the Great Recession. And he responded to it like a good Reaganite Republican, and to some extent, which is first you do stimulus, and people forget that Reagan did a lot of stimulus, but then you worry enormously about budget deficits, and you swing quickly to an austerity program. And that's what President Obama attempted to do in July of 2011, reached an agreement in principle with the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, a conservative but not Tea Party type Republican. And the deal, the Great Betrayal, or what they called the Grand Bargain, had these components. It was going to make very large cuts in social programs. It was going to make strong cuts in the safety net. So those are things like Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, those types of things. And it was going to make minor increases in taxation, or really tax revenues, from, to some extent, wealthier Americans, mostly by closing loopholes. That was the centerpiece of the deal. Now, that was significantly insane as a policy matter, because when you adopt austerity in the context of a weak recovery from a great recession, you throw the nation back into recession. Unemployment rises substantially. Your budget deficit grows enormously because you lose tax revenues and increase expenses to try to deal with the increased unemployment and poverty. And, of course, all of this would be far more brutal on the people affected, because you would be eroding the safety net simultaneously and the government programs designed to help them. And the other thing, of course, you'd do on the political side is you would be committing political suicide, both for your reelection chances and for your party, which would have lost control of the Senate, lost further in the House, and lost state elections all over the place that would have led to even greater gerrymandering and even greater Democratic Party losses in the future. So this was, on every possible dimension, a terrible, terrible plan. It was terrible economically. It was a betrayal of everything the Democratic Party had stood for, and it was both personally and party-wise suicidal. And the irony, of course, is that Obama was saved not by anything he did, but by the Tea Party, which eventually put enough pressure on Boehner that he wouldn't agree to even the most minimal closing of tax loopholes on the rich. And so the deal died. But let's go back in time. This is July 2011. Unemployment was still at 9.1%. Within a few months of adopting this kind of austerity regime, we, like Europe, would have been thrown back into the recession. Unemployment would have shot well above 10%. And all through 2012, as you were running up to the election, on every month, unemployment would have been going up. There would have been no chance, whatever President Obama's ground game was, however bad a candidate the Republicans put up, he would have simply been toast. Obama would have been toast.
So, William K. Black, again, former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, who investigated the savings and loans disaster of the 1980s, and currently professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. Presumably, President Obama understands this, surely. And equally true, I imagine, is that the Republicans remember the deal that was on the table. So in this grand bargain that they're meeting over, they probably will insist that, that's still on the table. And I don't understand why this whole thing is called a fiscal cliff, what the urgency is here. Why not wait till January when the Bush tax cuts expire?
Well, there is no fiscal cliff. That's a deliberately provocative phraseology designed to create phony pressure to move. What will happen is some of the tax reductions by Bush will expire. And over the course of the year, there'll be higher taxation. But everybody knows that they're going to agree to reduce taxes, at least for the great bulk of Americans, and they will make it retroactive to the beginning of the year. So that's not going to have much effect. There will be cuts in spending, but the cuts in spending that they're about to agree to will probably be bigger on the domestic side than the fiscal, so-called fiscal cliff would do. So that's not the real issue either. I would be less confident than what you've expressed that Obama understands this. He has, the last time around, he was listening to the advice of this group called the Third Way that had provided him with his chief of staff. Third Way is this front group that pretends to be a moderate to liberal democratic think tank and is really completely dominated and was set up by Wall Street to represent the interests of Wall Street. And what I haven't explained to this point is why Wall Street is so interested in the great betrayal of the safety net. And the answer is Social Security. What Third Way openly wants, what Pete Peterson, the Republican billionaire who is behind these efforts, who came from Wall Street and has said he will spend $1 billion of his own money, so this is another one of these Adelson types screwing up America with their vast wealth, or at least trying to screw up America, is they want to privatize Social Security. Now, it won't happen all at once. It'll happen in stages. But just as only a conservative Republican president like Nixon could go to China because of the politics, only a Democratic president can open up the and begin the betrayal of the safety net programs. Because right now, for the Republicans to touch them on the national level is to touch the third rail, you know, instant death through electrocution. So Obama is going to open that door, and once he does and accept the Republican arguments, which, by the way, are completely false, that we have no choice, that we must destroy the safety net, that the safety net is the ruination of America, all this nonsense. Once he accepts those arguments and starts the process, then whenever the Republicans get the majority again, they'll have the political opening they've long wanted. And if you privatize Social Security, of course, what you do is produce trillions of dollars that Wall Street will now be able to get the fees on for investing them in these private retirement accounts. And that is going to mean hundreds of billions of dollars in additional wealth to Wall Street, which is, of course, already obscenely too economically and politically powerful. So this is a horrific idea, and the idea, of course, of austerity is so self-destructive, and we've just run an experiment. Europe did that. Look at Europe. Europe has unemployment rates, the Eurozone, half again as large as the United States. So we're, you know, right around 8, they're over 12 percent. It's an insane policy, but that's precisely the policy that President Obama's primary financial advisor has been pushing. And that, of course, is Timothy Geithner, who is not an economist, not a regulator, a failed regulator, somebody who didn't pay his taxes. By the way, didn't pay his Social Security payroll taxes. So, irony of irony, and he runs the IRS now. And has been quoted, and without, you know, has never denied it, that he said that stimulus is worthless and that it's, quote, like sugar or candy. And was then told by the president's top economist, you're insane, it's not like that at all. In fact, it's more like taking medicine and an immune shot to get over a terrible health crisis and such. But the president ignored his principal economic advisors and relied instead on Geithner and relied on this senior person from Third Way, who was a J.P. Morgan guy, and was his chief of staff, Mr. Daley, at the time. So there's actually no sign that President Obama understands that he tried to, with his so-called grand bargain, do terrible damage to the American economy, inflict enormous suffering on the American people, and betray the crown jewel of the Democratic Party, which is the safety net programs and all the promises the Democratic Party has made to protect that program and the Americans, and that's essentially all Americans, at some point in their lives, take advantage of the safety net. We're supposed to betray the party's promise to protect it.
So, William K. Black, clearly Pete Peterson's billion-dollar sales job on the sky is falling because of this deficit that they keep drumming up as the looming catastrophe. And as you pointed out, they managed to tie this notion of fiscal cliff into that sky is falling idea, which feeds into the idea that we have an impending crisis. There is no crisis with Social Security. Who's going to push back and point out that the emperor has no clothes in this argument? Social Security is first of all, it's not an entitlement. It's something that people pay for. It's something that they own. It's a public trust, and it is solvent. And furthermore, to make it even more solvent into the future, all you have to do is add a little extra fees on the wealthy who don't need Social Security as much as regular people do and yet benefit from it. So who's pushing back and saying, wait a minute, why are we going after something? In other words, it's an old expression, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, yeah, and it's even worse here, right? So first, why does the fiscal cliff exist? And the answer to that is because Obama and Boehner deliberately created it. When they failed to get their grand bargain, the Great Betrayal, they instead deliberately created a trigger to create austerity. No, and here, you know, they created so much austerity that even they knew that if you did nothing, it would throw the economy back in recession. Now, that is grotesquely irresponsible, right? But it's worse than that. So what they're telling us, listen to this logic. Because the fiscal cliff, which is, again, is austerity, would throw the nation into recession, cause mass unemployment, and actually increase the deficit as opposed to decreasing it, we must avoid that austerity. And the way we must avoid that austerity is to adopt austerity. Through the grand bargain or great betrayal, which is even greater austerity. So this stuff is so incoherent that to even use the word coherent in the sentence as part of incoherent is misleading. This is literally nuts. And you have nobody in the mainstream, and that was what I was writing, listening to 6 hours of MSNBC, which, you know, has long supported stimulus, has long supported the safety net programs. They just treated it as obvious that there was only one answer, that this grand bargain was the greatest thing ever. We should all sing Kumbaya and do our bipartisan dance, and anything that was bipartisan must be good, even if it was a bipartisan suicide pact that betrayed the people most in need in America. So it's nuts on every dimension. Who's fighting it? Well, of course, people like us are fighting it, but the particularly good news is the AFL-CIO and other unions are very active in fighting it as well. And what this election made clear is, you know, that ground game and that get out the vote and all that good stuff, that was many people, but that was overwhelmingly union workers and progressives. That is the reason, along with the irony that the Tea Party saved Obama from the July 2011 deal, as I explained, were the reasons why Obama was reelected. And so it's time for people to remind President Obama about that. Here's the great danger. In addition to the kumbaya stuff about being bipartisan, all presidents, when they get in their second term, start thinking instantly in terms of legacy. What's going to leave my, you know, my mark on history? And Obama, this is very clear from what his own people said in the July 2011 negotiations. They see this grand bargain as his place in history. They know that, you know, the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, was really an embarrassment. Obviously, the president didn't warrant that kind of prize, and especially so early in his term. They all know he hadn't accomplished that. So when they look for the lasting accomplishment, they phrase this as courageous, right? That he's willing to turn on his base and betray them, that he's willing to betray the weakest people in need, most in need, the poorest Americans. That's being pictured by White House spin experts as courage. And of course, it is precisely the opposite. That kind of callous betrayal is the most cowardly of acts, and people need to call him on it. This is stuff that can't pass the simplest test of logic, as I've been explaining. So it really has to be fought, and fought hard. I explain in one of my pieces how Chris Matthews actually said that it was imperative that we not listen to Paul Krugman's arguments that this was a terrible deal and that there was no dastardly fiscal cliff that compelled action now. And he said, the president has to say, I'm the president, you're a columnist. Now, mind you, we're talking about economics. In fact, we're talking about macroeconomics, in which Paul Krugman won a Nobel Prize on the merits because of his expertise, and a guy that has had, generally speaking, quite a strong record of success predictively about all these aspects of the crisis. And Chris Matthews, MSNBC, the greatest sycophants, you know, for Obama, don't bother to explain any reason why we should engage, you know, enter into the great betrayal. They just say, you must not read the opposition. You must not listen to economists about the economy. So, you know, let's try that same idea. You know, let's say we were going to the moon and a Nobel Prize winning physicist said, you know, your plan to get to the moon relies on really bad physics and it's going to fail. And you know, let's say that the Nobel physicist wrote that in a column. Chris Matthews wants the president to stand up and said, you're a columnist, I'm a president. We're going to go to the moon my way.
Well, William K. Black, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with William K. Black, who is the former litigation director of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. He investigated the savings and loan disasters of the 1980s and currently is professor of economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He was the executive director of the Institute for Fraud Prevention from 2005 to 2007 and is the author of the best-selling book, The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own One. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how much the president has drunk the deficit Kool-Aid.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Let's Not Make a Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And in not making a deal, of course, you're referring to the so-called fiscal cliff, which in itself is a piece of sort of right-wing framing, if you will, in the sense that it's a part of, feels like a part of Pete Peterson's The Sky is Falling. It has a kind of apocalyptic feel to it, that we're going to go off a cliff. My understanding is that, you know, it's no big deal in as much as if the president does nothing, the onus is going to be on the Republicans. So why all the hysteria?
Well, let's separate the substance from the tactics. Substantively, $607 billion worth of automatic cuts are due to kick in the first of the year because of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the expiration of the temporary cut in the Social Security payroll tax, and then you've got this automatic sequester deal that the Republicans hung around the president's neck in 2011 as the price for extending the debt ceiling. So it would not be good if that happened. That's the substance. The tactical situation is what you say it is. The president holds all the cards because he and his party just won the election. And the Republicans kind of have to come to him. And the business community is terrified that if this fiscal cliff were to go off, it would be a big contraction in the economy. So Obama has a lot of power right now if he chooses to use it in a good way. And I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised by Obama's recent press conference today, where he basically said that he's not going to give in on the issue of the top 2% not getting a continuation of the Bush tax breaks. Also, at a meeting with labor leaders yesterday, he said he's going to be looking for another $600 billion in other tax increases on rich people, and he wants to get as much deficit reduction as he can by increasing taxes on the wealthy without cutting into programs. So far, so good. The problem is that Obama buys the premise that we need a lot of deficit reduction, and that's where I think he's off base. He committed during the campaign and before the campaign to $4 trillion of deficit reduction over 10 years. And the point I keep making is that if a so-called fiscal cliff of $600 billion in 1 year is bad, an Obama cliff of $4 trillion over 10 years is almost as bad. So we don't need those deficit cuts. If anything, we need increased deficit spending in the short run because of Hurricane Sandy and the threats to our coasts and the need to invest in clean energy. So I do think the president is rather tougher than I would have feared, and I hope that he'll go the rest of the way and realize that not only do we need to not have cuts in Social Security and Medicare, but to get whatever deficit reduction we need by raising taxes on wealthy people, but not to do deficit reduction at all, at least for the first 2 or 3 years while the economy is still weak.
So, Robert Kuttner, obviously everything goes back to those dealings in July of and 11. And one of the alarming things about the deal that was ultimately scuttled by the Tea Party caucus was that what Obama apparently put on the table was pretty scary in terms of eviscerating the very legacy of the Democratic Party. So if you've already put Social Security and Medicare on the table, aren't the Republicans going to say, you know, treat it as though that's already a precedent?
Well, that's a wonderfully interesting question. Obama seemed to be saying, that question came up at his press conference today, he seemed to be saying, well, back then I put it on the table, but I'm going to take it off the table because we just won the election. We just had an election over whether the American people want Social Security and Medicare to be cut. We just had an election over whether they want rich people to pay higher taxes, and I won. And so I don't think he is in a mood to give away as much as he almost gave away in 2011. So in a sense, the Tea Party saved him from himself. He's now, you know, picked up seats in the Senate. He's picked up a few seats in the House. And he's feeling feisty. I mean, I think the Obama that we saw in the days right after the election is a somewhat tougher Obama than we saw during a lot of his first term. And we'll have to keep the pressure on him and see how this plays out. But so far, as one who's been very critical of my president, I have to say that I'm pleasantly surprised. It ain't over, and he could still cave in, but it's better than I would have feared.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He also has an article at the Huffington Post, Let's Not Make a Deal. So just a broader question, though, about the political DNA, if you will, of our Democratic presidents. They've both Clinton and Obama have said that they were influenced in many ways by President Reagan. They came of age in the Reagan era. What I find extraordinary is that the country has moved so far to the right, and the Republican Party has moved so far to the right that even Republicans now are starting to complain about Limbaugh and the crazies. But the Democratic Party also moved to the right. It looks like from this last election that the American people moved a little bit back the other way to the left. So I'm worried that we may have a purple president in a blue America. And I'm wondering whether they realize that the Reagan era is over.
Well, I don't think the American people ever moved that far to the right because Social Security and Medicare never ceased to be popular. The idea that the wealthy ought to pay their fair share never ceased to be good politics. And so I think the Democratic Party has been somewhat behind the people. And the fact that, you know, the Democrats picked up seats in the Senate, and for the most part, the seats they picked up are progressives replacing conservatives or progressives replacing centrists. That means that the congressional party is a bit more progressive than it used to be. And Obama now, not having to run for re-election again, starting to worry about his legacy, I don't think he wants his legacy to be 4 more years of a recession. So, you know, if we can figure out a way to have a movement to keep the pressure on, we may see a moderately more progressive Obama. I don't want to count my chickens yet. You're absolutely right that the last 2 Democratic presidents, really the last 3 Democratic presidents, counting Jimmy Carter, have been very centrist, even center-right. Wall Street has had much too much influence. It still does. He raised a ton of money on Wall Street. So, you know, it's going to be a long road back. But I think the fact that he's hanging tough on who should get a tax increase, he seems to be in a better place than he was in 2011 in terms of giving away the store on Social Security and Medicare. I'm still worried that he has bought into this idea that Pete Peterson and company are pushing, that the way to get a recovery going is to reduce the deficit, when it's just the opposite. The way to get a recovery going in a weak economy is to have more public investment, more investment in jobs, more investment in infrastructure. But I think tactically the Republicans are in a much weaker position than they were 2 years ago, And I think Obama knows that.
Well, Pete Peterson, who you mentioned, Robert Kuttner, he paid the salaries, I believe, for the Simpson-Bowles commission.
Yes, he did.
And you know, Clinton even mentioned President Clinton even mentioned that at the Democratic convention as a kind of worthy template to follow.
Yeah.
So
Bowles Simpson was one of the worst things Obama ever did because number one, it was bad policy what the Bowles Simpson Commission or Simpson Bowles Commission was supporting. But number two, tactically, it painted Obama into a corner. Where he appointed these guys come up with the idea of a grand bargain to cut the deficit by cutting Social Security and Medicare and raising taxes. And then Obama's in the position of having to either deliver or to disown his own commission. So we've got a lot of ground to make up before we get a Democratic Party that is as progressive as the country is.
So how did this deficit Kool-Aid get taken so seriously and to have this president and his predecessor, Democratic predecessor, Bill Clinton, drink the Kool-Aid? And it's so obvious, well, at least it's obvious to me, that Pete Peterson, being a Wall Street billionaire, may not have the interests of working Americans at heart,
right.
And he may just want to get his hands on, and Wall Street may want to get their hands on all this money. After all, remember when George W. Bush got reelected, he went to the public and said, I've got some political capital and I'm going to spend it. And what did he spend it on? Trying to privatize Social Security.
Right. Well, Peterson's been at this for 30 years. Bob Rubin has been pushing this for 30 years. I mean, Rubin started out as a Democratic fundraiser back when he was co-chair of Goldman Sachs, and he cozied up to Walter Mondale, persuaded Mondale that the single most important thing Mondale needed to do was promise to raise taxes and cut the deficit, and Mondale lost 49 states when he took that advice when he ran for president in 84. And so I think Rubinism has infected the Democratic Party. I think Peterson has now spent $500 million on propaganda to the effect that the single most important thing we need to do is cut the deficit. And the problem is the press, a lot of the mainstream press, has bought this idea that the deficit is an emblem of the fact that the two parties won't work together rather than the reality that it's the result of a Republican obstructionism. And so the deficit is taken as a kind of totem of good government. And the Fix the Debt campaign, which is 100 corporate CEOs, telling America to tighten its belt for the greater good, even though these guys are fatter than ever. You know, a lot of people have drunk the Kool-Aid, including a lot of centrist Democrats, the Washington Post, the mainstream media, and it's just bad economics. And, you know, the fact that Obama has backed off a little bit from it is a good sign, but we got a lot of work to do.
Well, surely, Robert Kuttner, a sign of the sort of economic absurdity of this deficit obsession from these deficit hawks is the fact that foreigners can't wait to put their money in this country. Nobody thinks it's going to go broke, do they?
Well, it's even more extreme than that. I mean, the federal government has never been able to borrow money at a lower interest rate. You know, when Reagan was president and Reagan had deficits of 3 or 4% of GDP, they were spending 16% of the total federal budget on interest costs. Now they're only spending 6% of the federal budget on interest costs because interest rates are so low. So now would be a great time for the federal government to borrow money, to underwrite infrastructure, to invest in job creation. I mean, the fact that the federal government can sell 30-year bonds at under 3% tells you that nobody takes seriously the idea that these deficits are going to create inflation, because if they were worried about that, nobody would lend the government money at that low an interest rate for 30 years. People are more worried about deflation. The banks are sitting on $1.5 trillion that they don't know where to invest because they don't see customers. So this is absolute Alice in Wonderland craziness, and it's just an indication of the power of corporate and financial elites, that this is the dominant narrative.
Well, Robert Kuttner, I thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Cutton, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Cutton is the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street's Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Let's Not Make a Deal. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about alternative economic solutions to empower Americans at the local level.
What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down and be grateful and say, should take all that you see to
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gar Alperovitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard's Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He's the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors of the New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gar Alperovitz.
Glad to be with you. Thanks, Ian.
And it's pretty clear that in the next week or so, as we approach this so-called fiscal cliff in January, that the same kind of drumbeat from the deficit hawks, who after all have framed this thing in terms of a fiscal cliff in these apocalyptic terms, in fact, the reason we have this so-called fiscal cliff is because of the Tea Party extremists who back last year brought the country to the brink of losing its full faith and credit and having its debt downgraded. And this sequester deal was a result of that kind of reckless behavior. So I'm surprised that the president and everybody is taking this so seriously. It feels like a trap to me. They talk about a grand bargain, but I'm afraid there could be a grand betrayal going on here.
Well, it's obvious that the whole thing, the whole debate is skewed nationally way to the right. We sort of take for granted that we must, this is the richest economy in the history of the world. And the idea that we would be tied up over this deficit issue is a reflection of how conservative, as you say, all skewed to the right, the whole debate has become, not only because of the Tea Party, but because of the weakness of the progressive side that hasn't pushed Obama into taking a much stronger position. The Paul Krugman every day argues the Keynesian case for expanding the deficit in order to grow the economy. And there certainly is a traditional liberal case that could be made for that, let alone a radical case. But the debate has been taken over by the right and by the Tea Party, and Obama is working within that constraint, and so far has shown no indication that he's willing to really go to the country and try to turn it around.
Well, it's also, you know, MSNBC is supposedly the liberal media, and Chris Matthews of MSNBC has been basically telling Paul Krugman to shut up, saying you're a columnist. We're talking, you know, about great matters of state. Well, first of all, you know, Krugman's more than a columnist. He's a Nobel Prize-winning economist whose Nobel Prize is in macroeconomics. So surely he's qualified to speak on this matter.
Well, it's ridiculous to say he should be quiet on this matter. And not only that, the argument is very well supported throughout any part of the advanced economics field that strong buildup of deficits is important at this time to get the economy into high gear. I once had an elderly aunt who told me kind of the best thing I ever learned about economics, and I'm an economist. She said, you know, I lived in the Depression, and there wasn't much money around in the Depression, and we had a lot of unemployment. And then they decided to have a war, and all of a sudden there was a lot of money around, which meant, obviously, if you want to, if you have the political will, the economy could be put into high gear, and what's stopping it is not economics. Let me put it this way. We don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem managing the wealthiest economy in the world, and we've taken a right-wing or very conservative approach to that and allowed ourselves to be boxed in.
So this is odd, though, isn't it, Guy Arpovitz, that we have a blue country with a purple polity, or if not, a red polity?
No, I wish we had. I wish our country were bluer. I think the underlying structural problem, the reason we don't have a stronger liberal politics at the moment, I think, is a decline of labor. Throughout the advanced industrial world, if you don't have strong labor unions, you have a weak progressive politics. And I don't know if we're going to rebuild labor. We're going to have to build new institutions of some kind to support a progressive politics. We're seeing a lot of worker-owned companies and co-ops and maybe the kinds of ingredients that might go into a new institutional base to build a power base. But at the moment, I think a lot of our weakness comes from the fact that labor is so weak, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with Guy Arpovitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official, currently is professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, and his most recent books are America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. But we are, according to this results of this recent election, we are a blue country, and we're going to get bluer, and we're going to get more progressive. So again, I feel like our politics are out of step with our population.
Our politics are out of step, but and I think the more that we can do to build a majoritarian blue politics, the better. But I really do think and a movement-building effort is another part of that, which is not simply politics, but an aggressive activist politics. But I think what people need to actually think about is building the institutional base of a real politics, because that adds, like the labor unions, a real institution and where the muscle is. And I think it's going to come out of a whole series of democratizing efforts of beginning to take over some of the healthcare institutions so that we change the balance of power in health, build up worker-owned companies so we can change the balance of power locally. We're seeing this happening quietly. The press doesn't cover it, but we're seeing about 20 states are considering single payer. If you get single payer, you're going to get rid of, that's going to displace one institution, the big healthcare insurance companies. I think what most people think of politics is simply elections and organizing to support different candidates, and that's a huge part of it. And a second part of it is movement building, much more active and aggressive, and demonstrations and sit-ins and civil disobedience, and that's certainly a part of it. But the third part of it, we often forget. Down deep, the reason the Republican governors attacked the labor unions is they know that that institution was really providing a good deal of the muscle behind progressive politics. And, labor is down to 7% in the private sector. So another way to do it, I think over time, we're going to have to simply begin displacing some of the powerful institutions. For instance, if you can do as in Vermont now and pass the legislature twice, in California, was vetoed. If you do single payer, you will displace the institution of the healthcare insurance companies by a public company, and you start changing the balance of institutional power along with elections and along with movement building. If we can do those three things, build electoral politics, I think that's going to really be the key to changing over time.
Well, Guy Arpovitz, so as much as the labor movement has diminished over the years and is down to 6% of the private workforce, still, the president owes labor a lot. He wouldn't have won in Ohio but for the help in the so-called ground game that labor provided.
He certainly does owe labor. We'll see if he actually pays his bills. That is to say, he may compromise. I'd like to see him actually repay his debt to labor, but we'll see if he actually does.
So what are then the pressures on the president? I mean, he's always seems to have had a kind of Wall Street economics team in Geithner and Company. There's no indication that Geithner's leaving. Wall Street didn't give him any money this time. They gave all their money to, they made a big bet on Romney. Again, he doesn't owe Wall Street anything, but he owes labor a lot. So who's weighing in on him, do you think?
Well, I'm sure both sides are weighing in, but he seems to have bought the Wall Street theory of economics, as well as the money, even when he doesn't have the money. Geithner's leaving, but who he appoints as Treasury Secretary may very well reflect the same people because he wants to keep the bond market happy. That's the whole theory of politics out there and theory of finances. We've got to keep those bond traders happy. We've got to be careful with the deficit. So long as that theory predominates rather than a very different progressive economics, we're trapped, and he'll look the other way when labor comes to the door.
Well, that, of course, is that the chief propagandist for that worldview is Pete Peterson, the Wall Street billionaire who helped finance the Simpson-Bowles Commission. And it's pretty clear what his motivation is and what Wall Street's motivation is in terms of getting their hands on all that Social Security money. I mean, there's nothing particularly complicated about this. So why has it become the holy grail of American politics, deficit reduction? It's a hoax, isn't it? I mean, Social Security pays for itself, for God's sake. What are they talking about?
Well, they're in a trap intellectually and politically. So long as they believe that unless they cut the deficit, the bond market will fall apart and we won't be able to borrow, so long as they believe the stock market will collapse, so long as they believe that, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The only alternative, as I say, the way to think about it as an ordinary citizen is, if there were a large war tomorrow, the economy would be going into high gear, and there would be a big deficit, and no one would be worried about it because it would be moving the economy and paying taxes because the economy was moving. But that requires them to take on Wall Street, requires them to take on a different politics, and we don't see any sign that the progressives have built enough power to make that happen. That's our job for the next years to do that until we can really alter the political dynamics.
So, Garapovitz, are you suggesting then that the bond market is bluffing, that it's kind of a hoax, that they keep telling the president and his advisors that you have to be nice to us because we're holding the line against economic chaos? And, you know, it's such a self-serving argument for them, isn't it?
Well, it is a self-serving argument, but they can, in fact, create a crisis. You remember Bill Clinton faced this. And, you know, his famous line, you mean if I don't do that, those blankety-blank bond traders are controlling the action? The answer is yes. They could run up interest rates and, you know, unless you do a full-scale, bold, ongoing Keynesian program, and I would go beyond that. I think the Keynesians are limited. Unless you're very bold about it and have the politics to make it stick, in the short term, they can cause trouble for you, and they will. So, that would take a lot of different political courage to go against them. But if you go full bore against them, you can win. But that's a different politics.
So you're suggesting the president should go full bore, because otherwise they'll nickel and dime him to death if he takes the more incremental or modest route. What would going full bore mean to you? Just spell it out if you would.
Full bore program. The full bore program would be a major public investment in mass transit, in schools, in housing, in roads, in advanced development of energy, many, you know, billions and even up to the $1 trillion numbers, and move the economy from basically 20% de facto unemployment to 3% and really make the economy work. Think of World War II. Make the economy go full bore. And then all of a sudden you'd begin seeing tax revenues because everybody's working. But that would take a very bold and a different political culture and a different political leadership to be able to do that. But the economy is a very rich economy that has that capacity. We haven't built the politics to do that, and that's what's missing, the political side.
And what about infrastructure? I mean, it's not just we've seen what's happened with the Hurricane Sandy and the devastation to infrastructure. That's obviously taking a need for a big investment, but there's so much of the rest of the infrastructure, not to mention broadband and other things that could push us into the 21st century. Do you think that the president can make some kind of case that, like Jack Kennedy made for going to the moon? Is that what it's going to require? You know, you talk about going bold. Well, how about, you know, a bold challenge?
That's exactly what would be required, including broadband and including high-speed rail and including mass transit. All of that would be part of a bold package. But that's a different politics, and I don't think this president has that politics, and I don't think any president will have it until we build a movement and also institutions to develop the base for that kind of politics. So I think we're going to get, as you put it, nickel and dime to death, and we're going to find liberals voting to cut Medicare, and we're going to find Social Security later. You know, that's what's going to happen, given we haven't built the politics to make it happen yet. I think that's our job.
Well, but aren't there things happening, though, at the state level as opposed to the federal level? Isn't there some bottom-up movements happening in this country, like community banking and other things that maybe are setting a new example?
That's exactly my hope. That's the new book that you mentioned, What Then Must We Do, is exactly that. Working from the bottom up, building new institutions. There are, you know, the Bank of North Dakota is one, and there are 20 states considering building banks like that, public banks. There are 10,000 worker-owned companies. There are 130 million people in co-ops. There are 5,000 neighborhood corporations. There are 25% of American electricity comes from public utilities and co-ops. It's socialized 25% of the electrical force. Building out from those examples, like the Cleveland co-ops, there are very interesting developments of worker-owned co-ops in Cleveland and many other cities. That's when you build a new base for the new politics, institutional base, at the same time you build a movement. But that I think, is the job for the next two decades, to really do that, and then I think we have a chance of building a power base to alter the national equations. Bottom-up is always the answer. You can't do it unless you've got the base built up.
Well, you have to add to that list, Guy Alpowitz, too. The city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, has the best broadband in the United States.
Yes, indeed. And many cities have done it as well.
Right.
You know, I think several hundred cities have developed really effective broadband publicly, public utilities.
Exactly. Everybody that has either Time Warner or Comcast can tell you that you get lousy service and it gets more and more expensive. And it's, you know, nothing like the speed of what people in France have, for example, that they get for next to nothing as a public utility. So
exactly, public utility and public airlines as well around the world, and public banking. 40% of German banking is public. You can go down the list, and that's the direction we have to build towards. And I think we're just beginning to realize that unless we do that, we're going to not have the institutions that we need to build the next politics.
Well, Guy Alpowitz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Guy Alpowitz, who is a historian, political economist, activist, writer, and government official. He is currently a professor of political economy at the University of Maryland and is a former fellow of King's College, Cambridge University, Harvard Institute of Politics, and a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He is the co-founder of the Democracy Collaborative at the University of Maryland and a member of the board of directors for the New Economic Institute. His most recent books include America Beyond Capitalism, Unjust Deserts, and his forthcoming book is What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.